Well, good day, and welcome for another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Dr. Stephen McInerney, who is the Dean of Studies and Director of the Centre for the Study of Western Tradition at Campion College, a leading liberal arts institution in Sydney. He has a doctorate from the University of Sydney, a first-class honours degree in arts from the Australian National University, where he was awarded the University Medal in English. He served for many years as a member of the executive of the Ramsey Foundation. Stephen is also a published poet. Today we discuss what he sees as the major threats to Western civilization and Australian identity today, how his views politically have changed over time, and how he grew to better understand those of his grandfather, whether classical education and telling a better story, like the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship famously suggests, is a sufficient response to the challenges we face, how academics should engage with popular culture and how to get people interested in poetry again in an age of TikTok, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome, Stephen McInerney, to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's good to be here.
Yeah, you are, I think, the guest that I have known of the longest. So that's an interesting one. Yeah, because for those who don't know, we're actually university together. The same college, residential college, in fact.
With the same college?
We were, yeah. And now you're at Campion College. So for those who don't know what that is, what is it and how did you end up there?
So Campion College is a Catholic liberal arts college based in Toongabie in Western Sydney, technically Old Toongabie in Western Sydney. We were established, or we started operations in 2006. Basically, we're modelled on Catholic liberal arts colleges in the United States, especially a group of Catholic colleges that emerged in the 1970s in response to really the disintegration of Catholic higher education and the loss of identity within lots of established Catholic institutions in the US. There was a long formation for Campion by our founders over many years. And I finished my PhD at Sydney in 2005, and then the position opened up at Campion in a very timely way for me. Great blessing. So I've been here ever since with a brief hiatus here or there to do other things, but I've always been a member of the faculty here since that time.
What challenges do you think you would have faced if you had tried to continue to work for a major tertiary institution like Sydney University?
I did. I mean, I was doing my PhD there, and I did some teaching there. So while I was doing my PhD, and even I think I did a summer school there after I started here with Professor Barry Spur. But so the teaching I did there was with Noel Rowe, the late Noel Rowe, who was teaching Australian literature there. And he was also supervising my dissertation when Professor Spur was on sabbatical leave. So my experience of teaching there was a reasonably pleasant one. I think that was 2003. But already I could see that things that I took for granted as that should be normative in academic life were not being accepted any longer.
Like what?
There was a kind of, especially within a field like Australian literature. So, you know, one of the poets I worked on for my PhD was Les Murray. And I just noticed really that the emphasis even then in the teaching of Australian literature was on debunking, you know, this supposed myth of Australian identity and the myth of white Australia. And, you know, I was not in favor of that. And so I just, you know, I'd experienced it in a softer form, I suppose, as a student at the ANU. You know, I took a couple of courses on Australian literature, and that sort of, I would just say, anti-Australian element ran through some of those courses. So I knew that all these things that were really taking off in the English department, the emphasis on race and so on, that was going to be the future direction of English departments. And it had been. I mean, I probably sound naive for people that were in those departments at that time, because it had been already by that point for a couple of decades. But it was just becoming normal, you know. And
Barry Spurr, you mentioned. I mean, he's an example of someone who clearly learned guy, professor, I think, at Sydney University, wasn't he? And then he got suspended for some, inclement remark or whatever.
In a private email.
Yeah, which was, I can't even remember the details of it, but who cares, right? What happened to him? He got suspended.
Outrageous. He was treated outrageously. Mm. Yeah, it was disgraceful. They should hang their heads in shame.
Mm. But he's Geoffrey Blainey from an earlier time, probably Australia's best historian, let's put it out there. He lost his professorship of history at University of Melbourne back in the day. And I always think that once you knock off someone of that caliber from a university, it sends a message to the rest.
That's right. The cases are very different, but they are related in the sense that, I mean, Blainey was outrageously, his reputation attacked and so on because of his questioning, I suppose, to some extent, a mild extent, really, the narrative of multiculturalism and whether this was going to be beneficial for Australia. Mm. That was a clear sign then that things had changed in universities, especially in history departments. And Barry's was a couple of decades after that, I think, or 15 or so years after that. But it was the same kind of thing. It was, this guy has said some things in some private emails, which, were joking and, off colour and not the sort of things he would have ever said publicly. But we all do that. We say things privately. Mm. The university just completely abandoned him.
And it clearly, I mean, it provides then incentives for people to make those claims, but also for those who may hold conservative views or the views like Barry Spurr to not express them. And then it becomes a bit of a vicious cycle, right?
That's what it's all about in the end. It's about trying to stop the expression of ideas that they deem are dangerous to their agenda. It makes people naturally who have to earn a living and get on in the world, it makes them circumspect about speaking out. If prominent people lose their careers, then other people think, well, gosh, I'm not going to put my head up because it'll get knocked off.
Yeah. Our paths differed, and I went to China, and sometimes people think I'm over-exaggerating when I say this. I sometimes feel there's more risk to your professional reputation, professional life in Australia than there is actually working in Hong Kong. Criticizing China and Hong Kong, maybe there's some professional other risks, more so now than there once were. But if you so much as make any public statement on any kind of thing relating to, gender, race, and all the rest of it, you'll get blowback. You'll be identified as someone that needs to be targeted, and there will be consequences. And though you might not end up in a kind of jail in Qinghai, you will be disappeared to a certain extent. You'll lose your profile. You're allowed to post on social media now, but at one stage there, they were being kicked off that. You'll lose your financial livelihood, which is not nothing in the grand scheme of things, right?
Absolutely. No, it's insidious. And it's it's Orwellian, and we're living through it now. It's so obvious now what's happening, you know, in Europe, in the UK in particular, in Ireland, you know, a teacher who uses the wrong pronouns or just as a matter of conscience, you know, is sort of taken before the courts, loses his job, and now he's got to go and appeal to the President of the United States, you know, to try and get his own nation to see how insane they're being. And yeah, so it's really insidious, and really, notwithstanding the risks, the only thing that we can do is keep speaking out. I mean, we have to take that risk, because the danger of not taking those risks are worse for the society than the suffering that the individual may endure. That's my view. It's easier to say than do, but we just have to start speaking out before it's too late.
Yeah, those who can should. There's plenty of people, much more vulnerable positions, who for understandable reasons, cannot. So, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So those who can have a responsibility to do so.
There has been, there was an initiative, right, through the Ramsey Foundation for Western Civilization to change the culture by providing scholarships to worthy students to study at the traditional sandstone tertiary institutions. How is that going, and how successful has that been in your view?
So, well, you know, I should declare I was part of that. I mean, the Ramsey Foundation funds the Ramsey Center for Western Civilization. So I was on the executive of the Ramsey Center for Western Civilization, and I'm not any longer, so I can't speak for what they're doing now. But we set up, when I was there, I worked for Simon Haynes, who was the CEO. We set up partnerships with three universities. You mentioned the sandstone. It's true that initially that was the aim, was to secure partnerships with places like Sydney and ANU and Melbourne. And, you know, it went off track with ANU and then the usual things, that some of which we've been discussing, started to play out in those discussions. Ramsey was called racist and so on. And, you know, basically, because what is Western civilization? Well, it's European civilization, essentially, in its different expressions and incarnations in Europe, in Britain, and then in places that were founded, established, or created by Europeans in the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and so on. So, because of that, because it's Eurocentric, because, you know, it's the achievement essentially of white men and the women that supported them, but the prominent figures are all white men, you know, we're attacked as being racist simply for defending and propagating and promoting our own cultural inheritance to our own people. So the absurdity of that should be obvious to everyone, that it's absurd that this shouldn't be what's taught in Australian universities anyway. So the fact that we needed to exist, you know, that Tony Abbott, to his credit, went to Paul Ramsey and said, you know, I think you should give your money, put your money towards this, because we need to defend the West, and he did. And then, you know, it became internally controversial and externally controversial. And how successful has it been? Well, look, the partnerships we set up have, you know, it's been a number of years since I've been there, but they seem to be working well. And, I'm proud of what Simon Haynes and I and others who worked with us were able to do. It's a small thing, notwithstanding how much money is involved. I mean, it's a very small thing being in three universities and having these programs focused on the great works of the West, but it's something.
Mm. So what was the nature of the objection exactly? I guess it varies in each case, but fundamentally, why wouldn't a university be in favor of free money for students and to establish more of a focus or in a course which promotes something that has been appreciated by people of all, races and creeds, really? I mean, yeah. I'm sure quote chapter and verse, but I always like that line. Is it's by Frederick Douglass? He says, sit down and I, read Shakespeare and I'm communicating effectively man to man. He speaks to me, I speak to him, right? So what's the objection to that?
There's so many different objections that were raised. I mean, one was, this was a political enterprise. Universities taking money and it's having its curriculum dictated to it. So that all needed to be worked out. Then there was the content itself. The fact of having a Western civilization program itself was controversial. But then, bizarrely, we got these sort of contradictory messages. Oh, we're already doing this. So we're already doing it, and then from somewhere else in the same university, we shouldn't be doing it. we're not doing it, and we shouldn't be doing it. And then others saying we're already doing it. So in neither case do we need you. So one argument was, well, we're in a Western nation, so Western content already dominates the curriculum. Missing in that analysis is the fact that we all know that, as Bella de Brera and others have demonstrated, she did that on behalf of the IPA, that, a lot of the history and the stuff in the humanities, literature and so on, is taught in such a way as to actually undermine the legitimacy of the civilization that they're teaching, if that makes sense. So, and that's the critique, basically, the cultural critique that's come up, with the gender, race, sexuality, and class. Marxists have moved on from class, and the cultural Marxism basically focuses on the others now, on race, gender, and sexuality, and seeks to undermine Western societies through the critique of those societies using those tools. Mm. So basically, to demoralize our society and our civilization and our people.
Mm. But, what about the Catholic, Australian Catholic University? Surely they must be on your side and teaching people these things. Isn't that their role?
Yeah, so what I should say is I'm talking there about the objections that were raised to programs in Western Civ. I mean, once those programs were established, I think those universities have done a pretty good job. Within the constraints that the people teaching it have imposed on them by others, and some of which they've internalized. If you go to, you mentioned Australian Catholic University, their program with Ramsay is one of the good things they're doing. There's a larger and a sort of different set of questions, though they are related. About Catholic education, I think.
Interested. Because I think you have been critical of them, right? Say how much you want to say, but
yeah.
But what?
Well, it's absurd. It's absolutely absurd that Catholic institutions, built by Australian Catholics, to support the vision of the Catholic Church and the Catholic people of Australia, are basically used to undermine it, and what form does that take? Well, the idea that it's controversial to have a prominent Catholic layman, talking about his defense of human life from conception to natural death, you get a mass walkout.
This is Joe De Bruin, which happened a couple of months, right? And he's a guy from the long-standing Labour Party member from the Shoppies, and he's
classic old Australian Labour.
Yeah,
that is he cares about people, cares about working people, has advocated for the rights of working people in Australia, and his whole worldview is informed by Catholic social teaching. This should just be ordinary in a Catholic institution. You know, to the fact that you honour someone like that should be something everyone is supportive of, and of course this is great. But instead there's a sort of protest, orchestrated protest, and people, and then, you know, the
counseling emails,
Chancellor apologising to the students who are offended. It's completely absurd. And so, you know, it exposes the hollowness in a lot of Catholic higher education and Catholic education generally, not only in this country, but around the Western world, and points to why institutions like ours, Campion College, need to exist. But what happened at ACU is a reflection of what's happened in the society more generally. That is, institutions that are built for a certain purpose for a certain people are then basically requisitioned for some other purpose. So they've lost sight of what they were created for.
Do you think it's possible to reclaim those institutions, or are they lost and all you can do is build new ones outside it, which will hopefully, you know, ultimately become more prestigious and more influential than those ones ever were?
Yeah, it's rather like the question, can we reclaim our society? Can we reclaim our nation, our town, or whatever? I mean, yes in some cases and no in others. I don't think there's a one answer that fits all cases. It depends, you know, who's there, what kind of student body you have, where you're drawing your students from, where you're drawing your faculty from. Some institutions in the United States, I'm thinking of places like the University of Dallas and others, where they kind of went in a different direction and then they were brought back on track because they got good leadership. And you know, so some institutions can be recovered. It's very hard to see. Our universities are very monolithic. You know, there's very little diversity in Australian higher education. And so therefore there seems to be few opportunities to actually reclaim these institutions, especially in the humanities.
Yeah. How would you describe yourself politically these days? I remember you being a bit more Paul Keating, if you know, fanboy and Labor right. I always thought the Labor right was interesting, culturally interesting, a bit clubby. A bit sort of nothing happens outside of Sydney. These are all probably, you know, will. What do you think? How have you changed over those years?
Yeah, I mean, my family history is in the Labor Party. You know, my dad is a member of the Labor Party. Has been supporter of the Labor Party. So we were raised with that. One of my earliest memories is sitting down, watching the 1983 election. And so where Hawke's Labor Party defeated Fraser and Malcolm Fraser crying. I remember that. And I remember asking Dad what this all was and how he explained what it was. And he said polite things. I remember Malcolm Fraser was a good man and so on, but, you know, our people have got in. And so it was almost tribal, not unusual for kind of Catholic family with working class origins. My grandfather worked on the railways and was in the Labor Party. And so that was how I was raised. And, yeah, certainly at school, you know, at high school and then in my early years at university, that's where I stood, you know, on the Labor right. But I kind of shifted. It was that, you know, that election in 96. My memory is I voted for Keating, but I remember being strangely glad when Howard won. So that's when I thought, oh, something's going on here. Why do I feel this way? Mm. And it was because I'd kind of started to mix in more conservative circles, publishing in conservative places like the Adelaide Review and Quadrant. And people were, you know, my worldview was being challenged. But in a certain sense, I see myself really as being true to old Labor principles, mm. you know, the ones that predate really Hawke and Keating, going all the way back to, you know, Arthur Caldwell and people like that. But so I'm probably more like my grandfather in my worldview than anyone.
Well, no, it's interesting. I mean, I'm now more critical in some ways, even of the kind of Howard era in retrospect. I mean, so all these movements and political times had something to them and were, you know, endorsed by the people. And so there was, you know, there were changes that formed part of it, which were useful and necessary. But all of them sort of contained within them flaws, which became larger in time. And I kind of feel like a large dose of that patriotic working class with a bit of, you know, affection for Australian culture rather than, you know, deference to British culture too much has been lost. It was almost always the most admirable part of the kind of, you know, Whitlam-esque type of movement, although, you know, there are excesses and everything else, but there was a large part of that which was, I feel, you know, was useful. But the Howard, I mean, do they, how should academics get involved in the political process, do you think, Stephen? I mean,
that's a good question. I mean, first and foremost, as citizens, I mean, mm-hmm. academics are citizens, so we have political views. We shouldn't necessarily, gear all our classes so that our students have to sort of sit through classes hearing us talk about our political views. But we have political views, and so we should express them. But you know, what you're saying is interesting, because I remember very well those early years of the Howard government. And as I said, even after he won, I was happy. And then, you know, in 98, I remember it was a close election. I remember the dinner I was at where we were watching it, and I remember being happy again. And that kind of recovery under Howard of an emphasis on the nation and so on was welcome. And the world, you know, as I was experiencing it in Australia, was not changing all that dramatically. I mean, I know subsequently when I talked to people who were living in other parts of Australia, especially in parts of Sydney and Western Sydney, that it was being transformed even then in a very unwelcome way as far as they were concerned. And in hindsight, I've started to think, well, why was this all happening? And there was the Hanson factor in 96, and she hung around for a few years, and that was there. And I remember actually being sympathetic to her, especially the way she was mocked and attacked. At the time, I thought that's unfair. And there were people I admired, like Les Murray.
He stuck up for it. I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, he stuck up for it. And I thought that's, you know, he's a good bloke as well as being a great poet. Mm. And he just didn't like the way this woman was just being attacked from all sides for basically expressing fairly mild views that Australia should remain predominantly, Anglo-Celtic and European. Mm. In hindsight, I mean, the fact that she got so much heat back then points to a larger shift that had, you know, been absorbed by the mainstream political class and political elites, probably early as the 1960s, and which was really coming into its own at that time. And Howard pushed up against it to some extent, perhaps to the extent that he could. He copped flak in the 80s for saying similar things, that we need to slow down Asian migration, give it the nation a chance to absorb it, and so on. Mm. That was an interesting moment, the Howard years, a great moment in many respects. But looking back, I think there are problems, especially relating to immigration. But with academics, we're privileged in that we can speak our minds, so we should.
Mm. Campion College, along with other institutions, independent institutions that teach the Christian classical curriculum or great books course, or however you want to characterize it, their kind of mission was to, save the West by teaching the best that's been thought and said and inculcated amongst a new generation of elites, and therefore reclaim the culture. And I sounds good to me and was all for it. But these days I wonder whether what you're dealing with is just, you can't, if the culture is changing around you simply by mass immigration, no amount of great teaching or anything else will be sufficient to sort of convert that population en masse. I like to say, John Anderson at his art conference, he's a good guy, right? But he's not going to have a cup of tea to these mass waves of immigration that come flooding into the UK and elsewhere, and convince them that he's telling a better story. It's just unreal. Oh. It's completely unrealistic, right? Yeah. Nevertheless, that is the message that's being pushed. So, is it more effective? I mean, you've got to do everything, obviously, but is it more effective to simply channel your efforts into sort of stopping, allowing a pause so that we can then rebuild the culture along the best lines remold ourselves into a cultured, moral people, and then
you have to do whatever you can in the space that you've got. So on the question of immigration, absolutely has to be paused. Right? Mm. So if we are to, and by we I mean if the ethnic core of this nation is to remain the ethnic core, mm. and therefore the culture and the values that we generate are to remain at the forefront of Australian life, then we absolutely have to have a pause now. On the question of what we do in colleges, in schools and so on, well, really it's, you see it as a collection of families and extended families that basically come together to preserve their culture. So it's not necessarily... it's as much a kind of protective thing as it is about converting everyone else. I mean, in fact, I don't think it's really the role of a college such as ours to say, well, we're going to go and who cares who comes to Australia? We'll just go and convert them all to our good worldview.
Good luck. But I just think it's completely unrealistic. Yeah.
It's a completely naive view of culture and ethnicity and everything else. So, but you're pointing to something very interesting, right? Which is, this idea. So I've said to someone recently, I like what I'm doing here. I love what I did at the Ramsey Center. I mean, I love what I'm doing here and I hope to do it for the rest of my life. But, when I go down as I used to very often with my dad and have a beer at the bowling club in Kiama, I used to do that and used to love it. And I talked to his old friends and, these old Australians and so on, they're Australians. It does not make any difference to me, really, whether they've read Homer or, whether they know much about the Reformation or so on. In other words, so this whole idea about let's talk about the story we tell each other and our values and all that, it happens. All of those things come from a people, right? Mm. And yet you have high culture, you have folk culture and so on. It all interacts. But people talk in very Westerners, Europeans, especially British people derived from the Brits. Mm. We often talk and think in a very abstract way. So we talk about values and ideas, but what does it mean to save this value over here? I mean, Britain has not saved its values, right, of free speech and so on. It's lost them. But let's imagine, what does it mean to save it if you're not saving the people? If you're replacing one people with another, well, that doesn't help the you know, the old Aussies at the bowling club and their kids and their grandkids, because, you know, education is very important, but it you know, what education is for is educating a people. And if you lose your sense of yourself as a people and think that there's just this generic thing called Western values and we just sort of tell a story and the whole world embraces it, I just think it's very naive.
Yeah, I liked it when I mean, basically this podcast is me, with yourself accepted, chatting to old liberal market buddies of mine and trying to convince them why, heck, actually, you might be kind of wrong on stuff that I used to spout as well. So it makes for some interesting conversations. And most of the time, they hark back to the sort of 19th century British liberalism of Cobden and Bright and all the sort of, which is, close parallels to today, I would argue. And you're right. Like, it's not so much the high culture needs to be preserved and available. If someone from, you know, smart guy from a working class background wants to access it, the most important thing is to preserve the common culture, both high, low, and middle, right? And nations are more than simply bundles of liberal axioms. They kind of involve, to do high culture, you know, Herodotus said, you know, what are the Greeks? They're like a combination of blood, language, and the rights, R-I-T-E. That's what a people is. And if you've got to preserve those three things.
You've just given a great example, right? So you've read Herodotus. That's a wonderful line. It's true. Mm. So you've shown both things, right? That we need people reading these things, exploring these ideas in programs like at Campion and in the Ramsey programs. But the truth of what Herodotus says is what you want them to see as well, to access, and that's available to them. But that truth exists independently of Herodotus and independently of the people studying in these courses. And it won't ultimately depend on those people if you lose your people everywhere else. Because otherwise what you're just creating is a kind of a new elite that simply runs around the world doing what elites do, who are not really rooted in their own people and their own culture.
Mm. Yeah, and I increasingly, as a contrast to those British liberals, like to read people like Disraeli, right? Because they actually do talk about this bond between the aristocracy of his day and the kind of the people, the one nation sort of Tories, and we're all on it together. And I always think that whichever political party of whatever persuasion properly taps into that the best tends to be the most politically successful. If they're just too much in the world of ideas or too much in abstract principles, you know, we're going to remake the world in this way or that way, it never has true purchase amongst the community as a whole, and it never tends to work out successfully for the nation either.
Yeah, I mean, you need very smart people advising. Mm. Ideally, politicians, you know, Plato's ideally, the politician would be the philosopher, you know, very smart people. But short of that, you want politicians having very good, intelligent, intellectual advisors. But then the messaging and everything else has to be mediated in a way that all people of all classes and levels of education can embrace. And, I mean, that line you've given from Herodotus, you know, it's there, it's crisp, and people know it, you know. They know it's true.
Mm.
And I think there is tremendous potential in Australia for a nationalist politics that actually recognises this, that recognises the importance of Australians as a people you know, the importance of respecting the rights of workers. This is a great achievement of the Australian people and the Australian Labor Party, the old Labor Party. You know, recognises that we need a strong folk culture, a strong high culture, and we have all of that, actually. It's actually there, you know.
Mm.
Folk culture, you see it expressed in all sorts of wonderful ways, where, you know, Waltzing Matilda, but even just things that, you know, we've taken our culture for granted, that we don't appreciate how wonderful things are, like just going to a bowling club on a Friday night, with surrounded by your people, and it has its own vibe. The same way that if you went to a Greek club, it would have a vibe which would be expressing the Greek people in Australia. If you go to, you know, the leagues club or a bowling club, all those wonderful old things that our people created, there's a wonderful atmosphere, you know, and 6 o'clock in the RSL, people are remembering our war dead, all these things, you know, which are despised and disparaged by our elites. These are part of our culture, and we should be proud of them, and we have an obligation to preserve them and to pass them on.
Yeah, I mean, Les Murray, who I know you know well, he had that quite clearly really cultured guy, but didn't wear it on his, like, and was absolutely and genuinely enjoyed it. Wasn't affected, you know, chatting to the guy at the Bowser or what have, and I think that to me always, like you say, it's. In some ways, we take it for granted, but that idea that if a plumber comes to fix the Prime Minister's plumbing, that they're relating as equals, really, and the Prime Minister wants that guy to see him as a kind of equal. That doesn't exist in most places.
Exactly.
Outside the English speaking world, and even within the English speaking world, it doesn't quite exist to the same extent as it.
No, you get currents of it. Hmm. You see currents of it in parts of England, but basically, it's the formation of the Australian ethnos. Hmm. You know, people from predominantly from the British Isles, England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and then other Europeans, basically united. You know, uniting. I'm not saying they agreed all the time and so on, but you know, they were here together. In a difficult situation, and they built a nation, and it has a certain unique ethnic quality.
Yeah.
And when we talk about Australian values and so on, often that's what people mean, but they're hesitant about actually attributing it to those people that generated it, you know, and it doesn't exist without them.
Mm.
You know, it's there's a kind of strange rejection of biology and the body, the idea that we're floating abstractions. But no, it's all part of those people who are here on this continent who built this country against great adversity and then fought and died for it.
Mm.
You know, and everyone talks about this, you know, when you read accounts of both wars and even the Boer War, but, you know, the Great War and then World War II, that Australian soldiers had a particular quality, a particular outlook, a particular attitude. Yes, they're the descendants of people from the British Isles predominantly, but they've got something that is unique to them, and that's the formation, that's the Australian ethnos.
Yeah, yeah. No, no, the creation of a people, it's such a simple kind of statement, but that's what occurred here, and it doesn't occur everywhere. There are plenty of countries in the world that have. Are riven by ethnic conflict, God forbid. And I always like to say that, you know, Australia during the 20th century was the safest place for Jews in the world.
Yeah.
And that probably the place that could make an arguable claim that was the place least ridden by ethnic conflict in the whole world. I mean, it's not nothing to say that. You know, that's
no, and we have to acknowledge why that is. You know, that was the wisdom of our forefathers, and, you know, in the lead up to Federation and for 60, 70 years after that, recognizing that you retain a cohesive nation by essentially keeping it homogenous. Essentially, it was people of British ancestry and European ancestry were invited to come as immigrants. And that is one of the key reasons why there were major ethnic conflicts. The Jewish people were very well assimilated, actually, to an extent before the Second World War, to the extent that, you know, some of their leadership were terrified that they would disappear as a people because they had assimilated so well to the Australian ethnos, right? Mm. So many of them started to see themselves really as Australian Australians, you know, rather than as Jewish Australians, and that created some tensions, and the character of the Jewish community in Australia sort of was altered after the Second World War for reasons that we know. But yeah, people like John Monash and so on, these are great Australians. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that one of the reasons was that they had thoroughly, for the most part, assimilated. There's always this tension when a group retains a strong ethnic identity, which is not always the same as that of the Australian ethnos, you know. So,
I mean, obviously, the Jewish community have been the sort of, Europe's longest standing and most important minority group. And but in Australia and in the UK, I mean, you know, you had Disraeli, who was a Jew who became a prime minister. I mean, one of my direct descendants is Patsy Durack, who cruised up to the Kimberley and opened all that up. But he was financed by an Australian Jewish guy in Goulburn. And I just always think to myself, like, both of these guys didn't have countries, at that time, of Irish. Yeah. And so they were like, well, you know, this is ours. Well, this is what we're going to do. Yeah. And then later on, actually, the Duracks were responsible for maybe trying to establish a Jewish sort of safe haven there in the Kimberley. So it's been around for a while, but there has been, you know, there can be some degree of distinctiveness, I think, amongst people. But that wisdom of I call it, since the sort of 70s or whatever, there's been a cultural carelessness. People who don't really understand the differences in culture have just assumed that all of the kind of restrictions that were put in place must have been put in place for, you know, odious reasons, malign reasons, when they weren't. They were thoughtfully done.
I remember asking my dad, so he was born in 1940, and I should, obviously I'm representing myself here, my views, but I remember asking him, why did, because I'd heard about this thing called the White Australia Policy, and what was that all about, you know? Now, I was saying this as a kid in a thoroughly white Australia. I mean, there was in Kiama, there were like two Chinese families and some newer Australians, as people used to call people from Italy and Greece who had come after the Second World War. But a very homogenous town, right? And it all worked, because the super majority doesn't feel under threat. And so the couple of Chinese families, their children marry into the larger ethnos, and no one minds because the super majority is not threatened by that. But anyway, I asked my dad about this, and he said, your poppy, my grandfather, supported the White Australia Policy. And I remember thinking, why? And he said, because he just said that, basically it's a way of avoiding conflict. If you bring lots of different people from lots of different parts of the world who are racially or ethnically very different and distinctive and religiously and so on, you'll get conflict. So it wasn't because of any kind of bizarre hatred of all these other people. It was just, different nations basically are carried by different peoples. And that's why nations are different. That's why China is different from England.
Yeah, exactly.
And when I heard that, I thought that kind of made sense to me. I was very happy growing up and had no issue, when I knew someone who was the child of a Chinese immigrant or an Australian. Because it didn't pose any, they adopted the values, the features, even in some respects, but the Australian ethnos, but you don't get that with mass immigration. In fact, you destroy that.
If you have one ethnos, you don't have ethnic conflict. It's only when you have conflict when you have multiple ethnicities in this society we've created. To lighten it up a bit, mate, one of my memories from you was your ability to sort of quote Simpson quotes at random from college. How do you think academics should engage with the popular culture?
With the popular culture? Well, my colleagues here, I mean, we're always quoting Seinfeld. I mean, you put me in a, and yourself in a way, in a time capsule, because you know, it was The Simpsons when I was in first year uni, The Simpsons and Seinfeld, and they were taking off, and we absorbed them all. So, look, you engage. I don't think you do it in a programmatic way. You engage it because it gives you pleasure. And then it seems to say something true, you know, and so in different contexts, the truth that comes through, you quote it, and people who have grown up with that have this, in the same way, you know, people perhaps in better times would be quoting Shakespeare or Wordsworth or someone. But I think the popular culture is important. It's important to engage with it. You know, it produces wonderful things. I mean, rewatching Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's a work of art, you know. And I think, you know, I have perhaps reservations about aspects of The Simpsons and Seinfeld in hindsight. But actually, you know, there's a lot of truth in their observations, you know, essentially Jewish Americans and their vision of the world. Mm. So what I mean by truth, it's a very peculiar kind of look at the world, and sometimes that can open up little vistas onto the larger culture, which are important too.
It was all we had back then, I remember. These days, you're inundated by content, right? But it was literally
what
like...
I didn't know. This is interesting too in hindsight, and I'm not saying this to get back to a serious topic, but what we didn't know was how prominent a kind of Jewish vision of the world was in our lives, you know, in The Simpsons and in Seinfeld and in Hollywood films and in television generally, know, that we took it as American, you know, we thought this is an American thing, but it's a particular ethnic group within America with a particular worldview. But look, The Simpsons and Seinfeld are so funny and so clever. I was thinking, The Simpsons quote came to me the other day now that you mentioned it, because there's an episode where the DJs on a radio program have a competition to give away, you know, money to the first caller or a gimmick prize of an elephant. And no one, of course, chooses the elephant, but of course, Bart chooses the elephant. And then they don't have an elephant and they're going to get sued unless they come up with an elephant. And then the executive of the radio station comes in with a trolley, and on it is this thing called the DJ 3000. And the DJ 3000 just says these inane things that radio DJs say. And she says, "You either get that kid an elephant, or I'll replace you on Monday with the DJ 3000. And then, one of them hits it like this, and it says, "What about those clowns in Congress? What a bunch of clowns!" And the other guy says, "How does he keep up with the news like that?"
Yeah.
And I thought, this is, you know, it's just so true. And now this is happening. I mean, I was listening to the radio the other day. It had two prominent Sydney DJs, and at the end they announced that this was all AI. It wasn't them.
Like, oh, really?
And they do that now once a week. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is happening. You know, the DJ 3000 has come true.
Oh, it's so ingrained. I can't ride a monorail without... Monorail.
I know. How good is it?
Yeah. How do you get, though, at the same time when young people are inundated by this, you know, TikToks and everything else, how do you get them interested in poetry, which I know is your great love, in an age of TikTok?
Clive James actually was right when he said that, you know, lyric poetry gives you more bang for buck, right? So you get more out of a short lyric poem than you do out of a novel. That's always been my experience, because it's you know, as Coleridge said, the best words in the best order, right? So it's language at its best. But if you think about Twitter and things like this, or X, or Instagram, or whatever else, and you present to a student, "Look, we're not going to read Tolstoy's War and Peace this week. we're going to look at four short lyrics by Jared Manley Hopkins." I mean, you can actually retain their attention spans. You can get them to focus on something like that. This is one of the reasons why the close analysis of lyric poems took off in the 60s, I think, under the influence of the New Critics from the 40s and the 50s. You know, because of television, I think it actually meant, well, a teacher can come into class and put a poem by Robert Frost down and spend an hour on one poem and everyone has a pretty good time. You know, it doesn't require a lot of pre-reading or preparation and so on. But that's not the reason we read poetry. I mean, poetry you read for delight. You know, it begins in delight and ends in wisdom, and then wisdom is the prelude to or wonder, really. It begins in delight and ends in wonder, and then wonder leads to wisdom. So you do it, you show them why it's pleasurable. You know, it's the only way.
Who would you recommend, Stephen, if someone, you know, is interested in all thing culture but probably hasn't picked up a poem for a million years, of which I'm sure there are a large percentage of the population, how would you recommend they get back into it? Or just an anthology of British verse?
Look, there's lots of ways. I mean, depending on who they are, you know, but a good anthology is a good way. I mean, that's how I was really sort of initiated in the tradition, was to just read through anthologies. And some of the best anthologies are hard to get. You know, the best anthology of Australian poetry was one edited by Robert Gray and Geoffrey Lehman called the, Australian Poetry in the 20th Century, which came out, I think, in 1990.
Okay.
And that's wonderful. But, you know, I think young people, you get them interested in something like The Men from Snowy River. You know, Australian Nationalists the other day celebrated Banjo Paterson Day, and everyone was reading, I've read about this, Man from Snowy River, and so on. But what you want is a teacher that loves poetry, a teacher that has memorized poetry, who has absorbed it and can recite it initially, and you get students to delight in it that way. But, you know, there are good anthologies. I mean, even now, the Oxford book, the one edited by Christopher Ricks, the Oxford Book of English Verse, is very good. There's a, you know, even the Norton Anthology of poetry is good. I mean, it's a big thing, it's $100, but if you give that to a young person and say, here's your tradition,
get them to memorize it, right? Memory is committed to memory.
So wonderful, you know. So here we have students memorizing poems, but you get them some Keats, some Robert Frost, some Wordsworth, things like that, and some Australian verse. Philip Larkin is a great one. I've often found, especially young men here in my experience, you know, they'll often take to Philip Larkin because he's funny, clever.
I bet I know the first line that they always love, the which is very popular among young men.
Obviously, the verse is that the one?
Yeah. Hey, I know time. I've almost taken you for an hour. I could chat for a lot longer, Stephen. But if people want to find out more about your work or Campion College or whatever, what's the best way of them to get in touch?
The Campion website is campion.edu.au. And you can look for me on the website there. You know, I'm a poet, so my books naturally are not readily available, but there's some old copies floating around somewhere online. You know, and the same for my academic work. I mean, my scholarly book is not, I think, available anymore, but people can find it in libraries and so on. And otherwise, if they are interested in what an old academic or a middle-aged academic thinks, they can watch me opining on Twitter.
Yeah, that's right, or LinkedIn as well. And
LinkedIn.
You said if people want to learn poetry, then you've got to learn from someone who knows it and loves it. And
yes, I come to camp.
I know a guy, yeah. Hey, mate, really, really good to chat, and look forward to
talk to you.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Cheers, mate. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.